Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year. Welcome to 2014. You may still be shaking the confetti out of your clothes and hair, recovering just a bit from the partying, but just wait. The real noise this year has yet to be heard. 2014 is an election year. Florida will elect a governor, and in the months ahead, just watch how the fundraising totals and the spending in this governor's race add up, and add up fast. Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald and Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald along with us. Happy New Year to the both of you. Mary Ellen, let's begin with the fundraising that we saw late in 2013. Any kind of sense of history here? Have we seen this kind of early fundraising before?
It's been pretty much off the charts in terms of the amount of money, because they've changed the fundraising rules. And as of November of this year, individual contributions can have risen from 500 to 1,000. But that's just pales in comparison to the money that is flowing into these political committees. And for the governor's race alone, in the month of November, Governor Crist raised what in the past would have seemed like a huge amount of money, $3 million in 1 month, but Rick Scott raised $5.8 million. And that is just on top of the already $14 million he'd raised. So it is off to a pretty fast clip.
Mark, are we going to see, clearly we're going to see record-breaking numbers here in Florida in terms of the amount of money spent in this governor's race.
Yeah, and it's going to be ugly.
And we'll talk about the mudslinging here in a second, but it's going to be fueled by significant amount of dollars. Who is behind these early contributions?
It's usually the same cast of characters. It's just now that, as Mary Ellen mentioned, they can give more. Also in 2010, the code was kind of cracked by Rick Scott's then Republican primary opponent, then Attorney General Bill McCollum, who really used a political committee which have unlimited campaign contributions that it can accept from one contributor.
And so it's not just the candidate spending, it's the PAC spending.
Well, in the federal system, there are more rules kind of restricting this. Here, you can be a candidate, open up a political committee, and take $15 million from someone if they happen to have the money and want to give it to you.
As a candidate or as a political action committee?
As a candidate with your political committee. The,
right.
The real difference is you get a slightly lesser break on the negative and misleading ads you're going to run in your campaign. So the money we're going to see is huge. Rick Scott's talking possibly $100 million.
A governor's race.
For a governor's race.
How's that compared to what we saw last time around in California? Is this unprecedented nationwide?
I believe in California, Whitman had spent something in the order of $100 million.
We were close to that.
However, you know, Charlie Crist needs to stay about 50 cents to the dollar. So Crist people are hoping for about $50 million, and of course they'd love to have 75. And that just from them, there's going to be a mix of outside spending. There's going to be a lot of Washington spending here. It's probably more money than you've seen in a dozen states in the presidential election year.
Mary Ellen, these are really flabbergasting numbers that Mark throws out there. Talk to us, though, about those early donors and this usual cast of characters. Where's the money early on coming from?
Well, when you look, the clearest picture we have is from the governor's list, and that list is pretty extensive. I mean, we see money. There is money from Sheldon Adelson, one of the biggest gambling contributors. There's from the Seminole Tribe. There is money from AT&T, from Florida Power and Light, from every large corporation. There is a huge amount of money in the governor's campaign from health care and health care interests.
Mm-hmm.
And the insurance industry. And as Mark said, it's really the same cast of characters. The amounts of money that come into the state from out of state this time around may be perhaps the most interesting. We think that Florida's race will be definitely a bellwether for 2016 for presidential race. And I think it's also going to be a big stake race in terms of maintaining this governor's seat, either for Republicans or switching it for Democrats.
You agree
so
with that?
We'll see some outside money.
Yeah, Mark, a lot of outside Republican and Democratic money coming in?
Definitely. I mean, this is a place where I think both sides have decided, you know what, this is going to be a hill we're going to die on. They've also, both sides, decided, you know, Obamacare is going to be a hill we're going to fiercely fight over.
Yeah.
Despite what you're hearing a lot from our colleagues, from us, Obamacare isn't just a Republican issue to push. Democrats are actually pushing it, saying they're going on offense with Obamacare as well.
Absolutely.
A good rule of thumb back to the contributions is if you're doing business with the state government, you are contributing to Governor Rick Scott. Now, understand, when Charlie Crist was governor, that was happening as well. The bulk of Charlie Crist's money is coming from trial lawyers. A lot of it will come from union-affiliated types as well.
Mark, from a real practical sense, for those corporations, those individuals that gave during the last calendar year, is the clock reset as we move into 2014? And perhaps could that explain some of the significant fundraising on the part of Governor Crist and Governor Scott late last year?
What do you mean by the clock reset?
Well, in other words, can they give again?
Well, to the political committee, again, you can give as much money as you want.
Yeah.
Mike Fernandez, who owns managed care companies and does a lot of business with Medicaid. It's interesting. Medicaid's a program for the poor, but you realize there's millions of dollars in managing poverty. Mike Fernandez contributed $1 million check to Governor Scott. That's a lot of money.
Mary Leon Kloss from the Miami Herald, Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald as well. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Looking forward to 2014 and the months ahead, the significant amount of money to be raised and spent in the governor's campaign. Mark, you mentioned earlier not only a lot of money, but a lot of mud will be slung here as well. One of the big issues that Governor Scott, of course, is probably going to center his campaign around is the jobs creation that he's going to take credit for, rightly or wrongly, over the course of his administration. The economy is the key issue, and the economy certainly is bending upward here in South Florida. The job market has improved. The real estate market has improved. Maybe it hasn't been smoothed out for every income level, but it certainly has been pointed higher.
Yeah, there was a very good series that Mary Ellen can speak to in a moment from our combined Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times Bureau, looking into some of the finer details about Governor Scott's job promises, his performance, and his delivery. But in the end, from a 10,000-foot view, Governor Crist left the governor's office with 11.1% uninsurance rate, or pardon me, 11.1% unemployment rate. And Governor Scott is sitting on a 6.4% unemployment rate. Now, a lot of that just happens to jibe with the national trend as well. But in the end, to the victor belong the spoils. If you're at the top of the ticket and things go bad, you get blamed. And if things are going well, you're going to take credit. However, there is a really interesting thing that Governor Scott's campaign had decided, for some strange reason, to release a poll to the media saying, woohoo, we're number two. That is, they're losing. They released a poll showing that Governor Scott is losing to Charlie Crist by 4 percentage points overall. But there's a neat detail in there. When people were asked between Governor Crist and Governor Scott, whom do you trust more to create jobs, Governor Scott only had a 2 percentage point advantage over Governor Crist there, despite those unemployment numbers I just read there.
Right.
So despite the fact that Governor Scott ran in 2010 on a jobs platform and since then has essentially said jobs every single day, both publicly and privately, he's barely leading, if at all, over Charlie Crist in the whole reason for his governorship.
Which is jobs, that four-letter word, J-O-B-S. Mary Ellen, to that point, though, your exhaustive and, quite frankly, very insightful investigation into the jobs numbers and the job promises that Governor Scott made while running, and of course, has continued to made from the governor's position during his administration. Most of those jobs, in the estimation of the newspaper investigation that he could take direct credit for, have not come to fruition.
Right. I mean, the bottom line is that the state has put a lot of money, $264 million, into incentives to draw companies here or to find ways to expand jobs, and they haven't been able to produce those jobs. In fact, most of those jobs are going to be promised over a 10-year period. And I think that, to me, that is nothing. There really isn't anything surprising about that,
right?
Because this is the kind of thing that takes a long time to develop. What's surprising is that this governor decided that that is all he's going to be holding his hat on. That's his legacy. That's what he wants people to be judged by. And in a state where the kinds of new jobs we're getting are not jobs that paid as well as the jobs that were lost. So people feel that. We are also leading the nation, continue to lead the nation in the number of foreclosures. There are people who may be no longer unemployed, and the reason for that is that they've just quit looking.
Mm-hmm.
So all those factors influence how people feel about the state and about this governor. And he may be proclaiming that the statistics look good, but back at home, how are people really feeling? And I think that's what's reflecting on the governor's inability to narrow the gap.
I think that's a good point. However, not only should we look at the unemployment rate number, because it is going to be a number he's going to campaign
around. The 6.4%.
6.4% unemployment rate. There's another thing to think about that perhaps could be a more indicative number of how well Governor Scott will do on the ballot, and that is what you had mentioned and what Mary Ellen had mentioned, the real estate market. Mm-hmm. When prices continue to appreciate, people feel a wealth effect. When they can start borrowing more and using their credit card more and kind of ameliorating the fact that their real wages have fallen in real dollar terms, the wealth effect and the feeling of well-being certainly, I believe, will help Governor Scott. Now, Mary Ellen mentions we are still high in foreclosures, yep. And there is also an interesting phenomenon. We might be sitting on yet a new real estate bubble here where major hedge funds are starting to hedge in on our market. But nevertheless, a lot of people in South Florida are no longer underwater anymore. Some people are feeling their houses appreciate in value. They're starting to get those letters again, like, hey, here's $10,000 to go cash it. You know, there's a wealth effect and people are starting to feel better.
Sure. There's another name in the governor's race that we haven't mentioned yet, Nan Rich, of course. Mary Ellen, from your perspective, is this a viable candidacy on the Democratic side for that nomination that Governor Crist is trying for?
You know, I think that a lot of people feel that the question is, how long is Nan Rich going to hold on? Because she is not raising money. She is there, and she will continue to be a on the ticket or on the ballot, and there's going to be a primary as long as she stays in.
Yeah.
But I think there is continuing pressure for her to step out, and I don't. Maybe Mark has more insights about what it will take, but she's there for because she believes she has a voice. She's there because she represents the left wing of the party, and I think she wants that. That end to be appeased, and I don't think Crist is left or feel confident enough that it will be. So I don't know what it's going to take before she drops out, but I think she will.
Well, let's turn that around to the positive. What will it take for her to become viable? And forget about the money. That's a huge part of this, of course, Mark. We know that. But in terms of an issue, you know, what's the issue that she's going to be able to hang her candidacy on?
She's going to hang her candidacy on is that she is a longtime Democrat.
Yeah.
She is an unapologetic progressive. She is a liberal. She is a tireless kids' rights crusader, tireless believer in equal rights for gays, as well as an opponent of abortion restrictions. Mm-hmm. That is a supporter of pro-choice Democrat,
right.
Pro-choice liberal. But in the end, elections are by and large decided by how people feel about their candidates, and issues are kind of touchstones toward those.
Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup, looking ahead at 2014 and the election cycle coming up for the governor's race especially. A couple of other quick issues that I want to get your thoughts on, both Mark and Mary Ellen. Let's talk about Citizens. The state property insurance company continues to face questions from lawmakers about how they deny claims, litigate, steer policies to companies with little record or accountability. We know that Citizens is likely to continue to depopulate its policy members, especially those here in South Florida. The clearinghouse is now open for new Citizen members to purportedly shop for private storm coverage insurance like they have not been able to do in the past. Does this bubble up as we move toward the November balloting to an issue, especially as we look ahead to the next season? Mary Ellen?
Well, this is one of those interesting issues that it's always a regional issue. There's always more people in South Florida who are affected and hurt by Citizens and Citizens replacements companies than other parts of the state. And for that reason, I think that it's very unlikely that the legislature or the governor will do anything to tamp down the cost of Citizens for the bulk of people in South Florida. I think there's a lot of questions being raised, and legitimate ones, by South Florida legislators about how Citizens is managed, its strategy of failing to pay claims, its strategy of litigation, and all of that. But I do think there is something. You know, this governor, one issue that he wants to be part of the governor's race is the cost of living in Florida, and he is going to remind people that he held firm on not allowing any tuition increases for the last what will likely be 4 years. And he's you know, withstood tax increases, whereas he's going to show that Charlie Crist allowed them in his term. And but the one area where people continue to see prices rise is in property insurance. And yep. we have now reached a year where we have had no hurricanes in 7 years. So when that happens, it seems to me that people are going to should think, well, shouldn't my insurance go down because the liability isn't there? And that's not happening. So that, I think, could be an Achilles heel for Rick Scott. Charlie Crist could seize on it. And I don't expect the legislature to make it any easier for him.
Yeah, remember this with Governor Crist is in 2007, when insurance rates through Citizens were about to skyrocket. Crist led a very populist effort to freeze those rate increases, expand Citizens, and kind of make it more financially sound by accepting more insurance policies.
Right. Widening the pool of risk.
Correct. Now, Crist can make an argument to people like, look, I lowered and helped your insurance rates, or I kept them from rising. Governor Scott is going to have a tougher time making that argument. Like, I know my insurance rates increased by double digits, mm-hmm. and I'm in Citizens, even though I don't see how my house was uninsurable in the first place. So that could certainly be an issue. What we did see in 2007 is that Charlie Crist is not scared to demagogue a populist issue like property insurance. So Rick Scott should be prepared for that, and I think we'll see more chatter certainly around that, because people pay property insurance rates, and it's a lot of money.
Property insurance, real estate values, jobs, and income all at the ballot box as we move forward here in 2014 with the governor's race. It is the Florida Roundup, looking ahead at the year that will be with Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald and Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. Stick around. Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, Common Core in the Classroom. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, looking ahead at the year that will be of 2014 in South Florida, in the Sunshine State and nationwide. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Join the conversation with our live chat ongoing right now at WLRN.org, or tweet us using the call sign at WLRN. In 8 months' time, the Common Core classroom strategy is due to be fully implemented in Florida public school classrooms. For the rest of the school year, just kindergartners through second graders through the end of this year will continue fully immersed in Common Core. Third through 12th graders will experience it fully with the beginning of the next school year. Education is certainly a hot topic. Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss with the Herald as well. Sammy Mack joins us, State Impact Education Reporter here at WLRN, and John O'Connor, State Impact Education Reporter with WUSF, also along with us here. That live chat again at WLRN.org. Tell us your experiences with Common Core if you're a parent or a teacher or a caregiver, someone who has some experience with that homework that's been coming home for those kindergartners through second graders. And yes, of course, Mark is a parent. I kid you not, the homework for the kindergartners. Both you and I have experienced that firsthand. Sammy, let's start here with the Common Core fully implemented next year. Is there any reason to believe that that may be delayed?
We'll see. There were a series of meetings this year that looked at, you know, or took comment from parents and teachers and anybody who would want to come out and talk about it. The school superintendents in Florida have all asked to put a pause on it and to roll this thing out a little bit more slowly. There really hasn't been much indication from leadership at the state level that there's any interest in doing that. But we've seen a lot of changes in the past year. So,
yeah, John, the common complaint on school administrators and teachers and parents alike is the state tends to move the goal line when they've just constructed the goal post. Any thoughts from your perspective on the scheduled implementation beginning in August of 2014, August of this year, with the new school year, where K through 12 public school kids in the state of Florida all in with Common Core?
The interesting thing about Common Core is that it's different than some of the other state education policies, and that the superintendents, the school leaders, principals, they like Common Core. They agree with it. The only question is, how quickly should we make this transition, and do we, you know, jump in with both feet, or can we slow it down and kind of bring in more grades more slowly? So that's right. And so far, we've had a lot of debate about, should we keep the standards? You've had these meetings around the state. I think in the next year, you're going to see a lot more debate about how quickly do we make this transition? Do we hold off on teacher evaluations for a year or two, maybe, or do we delay the new test for a year until schools have more technology ready? It's going to be more about implementation than it'll be actually about the content of the standards.
And part of that worry that when we hear teachers and superintendents and the like who are concerned about the rollout is that they're really concerned that they're not going to have time to do what they need to do in terms of making sure that their school grades are going to be all right, that their kids are going to be prepared for testing, that their teachers know how to teach the standards in a way that makes sense. That's part of their criticism. But John's right. We hear mostly from folks who are in the classroom who are teaching and who are in administrative levels that they appreciate the standards being even across the state and across the country.
Yeah, generally supportive of the strategy behind Common Core. Mark, go ahead.
My wife's a second grade public school teacher, likes Common Core, likes the teaching of it. I am a political writer, though, and there is a considerate amount of conservative backlash. It's more kind of the far right, and there's a little bit of a union-affiliated backlash as well. Mm-hmm. It's a strange marriage. But there's a great amount of concern that, and perhaps even confusion, over saying, you know, Common Core is going to be teaching things to kids we don't want them to. People should know, again, that Common Core is, you know, not curriculum.
It's not a curriculum. Yeah. We've had that discussion quite often here on the Florida Roundup. You're absolutely right.
Yet it needs to be said again. Sure. But there is an advantage of these criticisms of these groups. This is parents getting involved and parents saying, look, I want to make sure that my kid's not being taught smut in the classroom.
Right.
Hey, great, but there's no evidence I've seen that Common Core is the one that's
being taught to be a communist or a socialist or any of those kinds of things.
Correct. Yeah. Or to love Obamacare or whatever. Right. Oh, well, that was an unfair comment. But anyway, so it is what it is.
Mary Ellen, the school administrators, you know, concerned obviously about testing and grading the students as we move into Common Core, beginning with the next school year, the fall of 2014, the fall of this year. You know, if there's any agency or any group that could stand between now and full implementation, perhaps it's the state legislature. Any appetite to tackle Common Core education at the state level?
The legislative leaders in the House and Senate have both indicated that they are very supportive, or not very, but they are supportive of Common Core, and they seem to be willing to let the Department of Education and the governor take the lead on the go slow approach to this. However, there is, just as Mark mentioned, a growing group, particularly in the more conservative House, where people want to pull back on it. They and kind of come up with the state's own set of standards, and we, you know, the governor has given that group some FaceTime, mm-hmm. and indicated that he's open to listening to them, but we haven't seen any indication that they're going to revamp it or come up with anything different. This is an election year, and going into the legislative session, if this is an issue that is going to bring on a firestorm of criticism from either side, I don't expect it'll get any attention by the legislature.
It could be waiting in the wings, though, because, again, you know, as we move toward August with the full implementation and the full force of Common Core and the Common Core and the strategy behind it, we need to differentiate that versus the standards, which is to judge being able to measure the relative success of the Common Core goals that are being implemented K through 12 beginning in August. And former state school board education member Kathleen Shanahan discussed changing this school grading system, even as supporters of the grading system say that it does, in fact, need to be changed. There's some significant concern regarding this. So John, let's talk about where this debate needs to go by August as we move into full-on Common Core, K through 12, and then eventually sometime, probably late 2014, some kind of standardized test to be able to measure it.
Yeah, there's a series of questions that'll have to be answered in the next year, the first of which being which test to test Common Core is Florida going to choose. They just had the deadline for submitting applications. We've had five companies plus one of these multi-state consortia has kind of raised their hand and said, we're interested. The State Board of Education is expected to make a decision by March. Once they choose that, then we can talk about the next step, which is the necessary rewriting of the school grading formula because we are now switching tests and right. standards. And so all of these processes, you know, it's kind of a step-by-step process, and the first domino to fall will be which test does Florida choose.
And Sammy, where are the superintendents in this? You and I both spoke with Superintendent Carvalho from Miami-Dade. We spoke with Superintendent Runcie at the beginning of this school year in August of last year, and both of them expressed a lot of impatience with the state and a lot of frustration with the state, not only moving the goalpost with the FCATs and the current testing standardization, but having such a big black hole about how are we going to measure Common Core? What's going to be out there? Tell me what that is. And then I can be able to figure out the tools that my instructors and my educators need in the classroom.
Yeah, that's right. They are really frustrated. The goalposts have been moving. They've been moving for years on all of this stuff. And there's some fatigue around the testing itself and the process of getting it and then trying to work towards whatever the standards are. What they do want when you talk to them is they want to be able to compare themselves to school districts in other states and other places. So for the most part, I think I've been hearing them say that they would rather have a test that is being used in other states. Right. One of the options on the table was potentially having Florida write its own test. But if part of the reason the states got together and created these Common Core standards was so that you could compare, you know, how
Florida,
kids are achieving.
To Arizona, exactly. To Wyoming, to
right.
Maine.
We've heard people say that it doesn't mean anything if you have a test that you can't use in another state.
The superintendents have come out and specifically said they don't want a homegrown test. They want a test that allows multi-state comparison.
And is that Park, John, PARCC?
Well, it could be one of many tests. PARC is a consortium of about 20 states that are working together to design a test. They would agree to use this test, and then the results of any state using PARC could be compared. There are also third-party tests out there. ACT is working on something called the ACT Aspire. Alabama is going to field test it this spring. And it's something that a lot of other states could adopt as well, as instead of going through the process of designing their own test. I've heard a lot of positive feedback towards what folks in Florida have heard about the ACT Aspire so far.
It should be noted that you were talking about the goalposts moving. The guy moving those goalposts right now has been Governor Rick Scott. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of been all over the map. Amid the conservative criticism over Common Core, he got weak-kneed. He pulled the state out of PARC, even though we were a leader in it.
Well, he didn't pull it. He pulled the state out of the financial leadership position.
Correct.
As the banker of the funds that are being used to develop.
He pulled
PARC.
Us out of a leadership position. Gotcha. Of it. He had talked about, okay, you know, let's put this kind of out to bid, even though we, the state of Florida, was helping design this.
Right.
So he held a Common Core summit and didn't go.
Multiple summits.
Yes, and so if you wonder why some people are confused about this, they're not quite seeing Rick Scott get his sea legs here. Now, part of the reason is that, you know, he campaigned and he governs as the jobs guy. I don't think education policy was really his thing, and he's still kind of feeling his sea legs.
That was a former governor's thing, I think it was, here in the state of Florida.
A certain guy named Governor Jeb Bush.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, and John, I'd like to know what you think of this. I mean, I've got a third grader in public school, and Mark, you may be able to relate to this. There is homework that I've seen that has PARC preparation, P-A-R-C-C, prep, written on the homework. So, you know, in other words, already, while he's not in a grade that is all in with Common Core, it's the blended curriculum this year, the blended strategy, the blended goals, I've already seen as a parent PARC being prepared for in the classroom.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I don't remember having, I went to public school in kindergarten in Florida. I don't remember having homework. But at the same time, I think it's good, not only for my child, but for me and probably for the teacher. It tells the teacher, like, look, here's a child whose parent is engaged in helping.
Yeah. John, I mean, again, you know, the materials that some kids are seeing, I can't imagine mine is exclusive in this, is already seeing PARC preparation when we don't yet even know what exactly they're preparing for in the years ahead.
Yeah, well, it sounds like John maybe has dropped off for a minute, but it's true. The state of Florida had been sort of headed towards PARC, and had you asked us a year ago if we were going to be having this conversation, I'm not sure anybody could have predicted it.
Yeah.
Because, again, we were in a leadership position from the beginning around the Common Core standards, state standards in general, and then with the development of this test that was going to be used across many states. And so as the standards have been rolling out in the early elementary school grades, and then as we see in 2014, all the grades, a lot of the preparation was sort of around
what was expected.
What was expected,
and
right.
And it may be changing now.
And that may be changing. And again, that's part of why educators and administrators are so tired.
And teachers and parents and caregivers. That's Sammy Mack with State Impact Education and WLRN. John O'Connor with WUSF along with us. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald and Mark Caputo also along with us here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. We're looking ahead at the year that will be in education. Funding on a state level does get some dollars from the state lottery. This brings up the issue of gaming and gambling here in the Sunshine State. And Mary Ellen, this is likely to be on an agenda perhaps in Tallahassee as we move to that state spring legislative session. For the second time in 2 years, the legislature will consider whether Las Vegas-style resort casinos should be allowed in Florida. Tell us about what is expected to be on the agenda.
Well, the big question is how much they're going to put on the agenda. The legislature did something that was pretty unusual, and that is they, or at least the Senate, conducted hearings across the state asking people to give them input on what they think should happen for Florida's gaming picture into the future. And the goal that they had in mind, in the Senate at least, was to come up with a comprehensive strategy that stops Florida from these fits and starts of, you know, expanded gambling through the existing gambling footprint as we're trying to diminish the number of dog tracks in the state, for example, but allow the dog track establishments and investors to stay in business by giving them bingo and poker, and now they want slot machines. And then we saw the internet cafe explosion happen last year, and that got shut down because of a state attorney, not because of legislative efforts. So we are in this, we've got this spaghetti's nest of parimutuel and gambling laws, and the Senate said, let's finally clear this up. But they realized as they went everywhere that there is no clear idea of how to get out of this mess. And in the midst of it, everybody wants to use any change to expand gambling somewhere else.
Right. Well, one of those places here is here in South Florida, where that debate raged not that long ago, seemed to be quieted down, Mark. But perhaps, where there's smoke, there's fire. We'll see. I mean, it may be tough in 2014 with the election, but the seeds for future expansion could be sown.
Well, the interesting perfect storm that you could see this year is you have the Seminole Gaming Compact.
Right. And this is the 5-year compact that essentially guaranteed the state a significant amount of gaming revenue from the tribe that sunsets in 2015, I believe.
Mary Ellen's better on the dates with that than I am.
But let's put it this way. There's a lot less time left on it than has been experienced.
And here's the question. Yeah, the question is who's going to negotiate that compact? Because the legislature thinks it has a role, but it doesn't. It is all the governor's job, and then the legislature ratifies it. The question is, if we do it this year, then Governor Scott, this governor in this term gets the opportunity to negotiate that. If we wait a year, whoever's governor, it could be Governor Scott, but whoever has it has to negotiate it, and we've got a whole new set of leaders in the legislature to ratify that. So that is all fitting into this as well.
Now, I understand that the Seminole tribe is probably all in to Rick Scott. That we understand they've pledged up to $1 million to him. But for the Seminole tribe, that's a rounding error in the billions of dollars that washes across their transom. And gambling is kind of a zero-sum game in that whatever they kind of get, the other paramutuals and gambling operations don't get. And so you see this in Tallahassee all the time, where when one special interest, especially in gaming, starts to get a leg up, the rest of them, like crabs in a boiling pot, pull them back in.
Yep.
And so it just creates a lot of dissonance and a lot of noise, and then sometimes it leads to more contributions and more fighting and on and on.
And that's why it's really unlikely, I think, this year. In fact, I think the odds are 50-50 that we get anything done.
Black or red, Caputo, black or red.
Yeah, always bet on black, as Wesley Snipes said.
All right. Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Herald as well. Sammy Mack, WLRN State Impact Education Reporter, and John O'Connor from WUSF State Impact Education Reporter as well. Still plenty more ahead here on this 2014 look ahead here on the Florida Roundup. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, and Happy New Year as we're looking ahead at the year that could be. In October of the past year, healthcare.gov was launched, but it really wasn't until Thanksgiving before it was working reasonably well for Floridians and others across the United States to shop and sign up for health insurance. This was all in preparation for the individual health insurance mandate, which took effect at the beginning of this year. Florida was one of three dozen states relying on the federal government to run and sign up people for individual health insurance. Mark Caputo with the Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald, Sammy Mack, State Impact Education and Healthcare Reporter from WLRN along with us, and Tim Padgett, WLRN America's editor, all with us here. Happy New Year once again to each and every one. Sammy, I want to start actually, though, with the Spanish language version of healthcare.gov, which had an even later start date before it finally got up and running. It wasn't until really the waning weeks of 2013 before the beta was out, the test version was out.
Yeah, that's right. Originally, the Spanish language version of healthcare.gov was going to be launched at the same time that healthcare.gov was, but right before that happened, there was a pause put on it, and the Obama administration said, no, we'll wait until October, and we'll do it during Hispanic Heritage Week. Mm-hmm. But by that time, October 21st, it was very clear that there were huge problems with the website and the ability to enroll. So there was a Spanish language website. You just couldn't buy insurance on it.
And you couldn't really see any plan specifics either.
You couldn't see
either.
The plans.
It was promotional
in
nature at best.
Right, right. It gave you the phone number to call if you wanted to talk to somebody over the phone, or directions how to fill out a paper application. But really, the functional side of it was not there for people who were shopping for insurance in Spanish. And so that was launched. There was a big push to get people enrolled. And this is a really important issue for making this healthcare exchange work, because this is a really big population that is much younger, mm-hmm. and that's the kind of population that health insurers want signing up.
And here in Florida, it's a significant number of people that are in that uninsured category that the individual mandate likely will hit, even though the fee or the tax in 2014 is low. This year, $95, I think, if you don't have it, if you're supposed to have it. But it's a, as you mentioned, it's a relatively younger population that helps spread the risk around. Tim Padgett, from the Latin perspective, it's also coming into a state that's becoming more and more purple, not red, not black, from a political standpoint. And as we mentioned at the top of the hour, a big political year here ahead, where the Affordable Care Act is likely going to show up even on some state and local races.
Yeah, the Obama administration and the Democratic Party and the Republicans have got to engage Hispanics and Latinos on this issue, because, as we've mentioned before, the Obama administration cannot show the Hispanic community that it got immigration reform done.
Yeah.
So it needs to engage this issue to show the Hispanic population, which for whom obviously healthcare reform is a huge issue, that it is thinking about them, because the Hispanic voter helped put Obama over the top in 2012. And if the Democrats want to show Hispanics that they're not taking them for granted when Hispanics go to the polls in 2014, this is one area where they've got to get it right.
Two things that are interesting and I think underreported by us. When Obama advertised in Spanish language media in Florida and the nation, he spent more money and more ad time touting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, than he did immigration. So he basically said, hey, folks, Obamacare is coming. And now it's like, psych. So they don't have that. So there's a problem. Secondly, it should be noted, they're the largest uninsured group in the nation and in Florida, a major group. And then there's a midterm elections problem is, for some reason, at midterm after midterm after midterm after midterm election, Hispanic voters disproportionately fall off the map. Lastly, amid Obamacare's woes and Obama's woes as a result of those woes, his support among Hispanic voters has dropped the largest amount out of any subgroup in the nation, according to Gallup.
Now, all of this, of course, and we understand that Obama is not going to be on the ballot come November of this year. Obviously, Governor Scott will be on the ballot. There will be presumably a Democrat on the ballot for the governor's race. Mary Ellen, how does the National Affordable Care Act and Florida state's response, which was essentially to outsource it to the federal government, play as we move into the heat of the gubernatorial race?
I think it's going to have a huge role. You know, there was a Massachusetts politician, Tip O'Neill, once said that all politics is local. But I think we've now entered the era where all politics is national. And Obamacare, immigration, those are the issues that, again, are going to resurface. And they're going to resurface in the governor's race. And I think that, just as Mark said early in the program, the Democrats are going to, you know, rally around and campaign on behalf of Obamacare. They are going to continue to go on the offensive with it. And but the flip side, we are seeing that Republicans are going to use it very effectively, I think, as well. And how that plays out will be interesting. And one of the places to look for this, mm-hmm. I think, is in this special election that we get to watch with some interest in Pinellas County, where the late Congressman Bill Young is being replaced, and it's going to be a fascinating race because we've got the former CFO, Alex Sink, a Democrat, running in a very purple district against a Republican that will be chosen in a January primary. And Obamacare is a central issue in that race.
There's another.
So we'll see where that goes.
There's another issue that potentially could bring out a certain demographic of voter. There is a healthcare component to it. Medicinal is in its name. We're, of course, talking about marijuana. And the. Did you like how I did that, Mark, by the way?
It's a smooth transition
there. Yeah, I'll point that out.
It's all about segue.
It is all about segue. But, Tim, I want to come to you from Latin America because the perspective from Latin America is key here. Because not only is Florida and the municipal marijuana debate looking at the experience in Colorado and the state of Washington, we also could obviously turn our eyes southward, given our population and given our interest in Latin America, to what's going on in the central part of that continent and the embracement of marijuana.
In Uruguay,
right.
Which just this in December passed, finally, this legalization of marijuana measure, which is going to be looked upon very closely by the international community as sort of a laboratory for how not just a state, but an entire nation can navigate this sort of drastic reform. You've got the essentially the government of Uruguay becoming the entrepreneur, growing, selling, and controlling
and taxing
the marijuana market. So this is a really interesting experiment that's going on, and that could have a lot to say about how this issue moves forward in the United States.
And it's certainly a lot to say how the population here in South Florida continues to view the evolving nature of looking at medicinal marijuana, the use of it, not only in the United States, but throughout the hemisphere. Mark, could this potentially play? What role could it play as we move into November?
I think it's an open question. I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal on the governor's ballot itself. It could be because it's something that's going to, it could bring out first-time voters, but I've interviewed some of the folks who have signed these petitions, and a lot of them are low-information voters who barely know who Governor Scott is.
But they're single-information voters, too, sometimes.
Correct. A very important number, 30. It's now January. We've got 30 days, or the medical marijuana folks do, to have basically 650,000 verified voter signatures to put this on the ballot. They take 683,000 plus to do it. And then, of course, the Florida Supreme Court still has to green light this thing to go on the ballot to decide whether it's misleading language or not.
But isn't another important number 60, which was, I think, the number, the percentage of Floridians who said they do want to see medicinal marijuana legalized?
I think 82 is 80, the last.
Okay, much higher.
But actually, you are right. It is 60% because if it does get on the ballot, it then takes 60% to pass a constitutional amendment.
Mary Ellen, from the state legislator Tallahassee perspective, close eyes obviously on the Supreme Court and the referendum, but also, you know, looking beyond even in 2016, for instance, and the kind of push here that we've seen, the now fully public debate over medicinal marijuana. How does it play out?
Well, it's interesting because both the House and Senate leadership have weighed in, and and weighed in with the Attorney General against the language that is before the court, and they both want to see the language struck. They think that it's misleading in their argument. They've got a lot of arguments, but I think the bottom line is they don't want to see this go on the ballot because they fear it will pass, and then they're going to get stuck with implementing it. So, but I think it is. I think Mark's right. I think the Supreme Court raised some serious questions, and there's a chance it may not. The language may not make it. And they still have a huge hurdle to gather all these signatures.
Yeah, significant.
It sure is. I also would like to just kind of take a cheap shot at the Florida legislature. For the Florida House and Florida Senate, which time after time after time after time has dispatched, sent to the Supreme Court misleading constitutional amendments, which have been subsequently thrown out for being misleading. For them to then accuse a citizens group of being misleading is the height of hypocrisy. But luckily, it's consistent, and there's nothing new there.
Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen Kloss also with the Herald. Sammy Mack and Tim Padgett here with WLRN. Mark, real quick, Mary Ellen mentioned the special runoff election in the Gulf Coast. Let's look forward, though, to some congressional races here in South Florida. Joe Garcia and Patrick Murphy especially seem to be those that are really going to be targeted.
I think Joe Garcia is much safer than Patrick Murphy. Murphy, understand that Joe Garcia won his seat by 11 points against a scandal-plagued then-Congressman David Rivera. President Obama won that seat by 7 points. Mm-hmm. However, Patrick Murphy's from Jupiter, he barely won his seat by a point. Obama lost that seat. You're now heading into a midterm election where Republicans disproportionately overperform Democrats. So Patrick Murphy, if anyone looks like a kind of a dead Democrat walking, it might be him, but I wouldn't count him out. Still, we should also think about the Tallahassee area. Gwen Graham, the daughter of former Senator and Governor Bob Graham, is running against incumbent Steve Sutherland. Something interesting could happen there because it's a government seat. This guy's a Tea Party guy. A lot of government workers from Tallahassee all the way through Panama City probably don't like the fact that you got a dude in there who doesn't really like government work and has helped shut down the federal government.
A little bit of local politics there. Tim, international politics also certainly plays a role, certainly for politics in Latin America. What's on the calendar as we look ahead in the expectation?
Two big presidential elections next year. The first being Brazil, Dilma Rousseff running for re-election, and a lot of that may have to be determined by how well Brazil does in the World Cup. Not just how well they pull off the event, but whether or not
they
even
win the
Brazil
event.
Because say what you will, that often does have a psychological effect. The other big presidential election is in Colombia. And that's important because that country is right now is knee-deep in peace negotiations with Marxist guerrillas. And the favorite, of course, is the incumbent, Juan Manuel Santos. But he's got his conservative predecessor, Alvaro Uribe, gunning for him because he can't stand the fact that Santos is negotiating with the guerrillas. So that could make that a very, very interesting race.
And he's also been very vocal, obviously, about the U.S.-led war on drugs and relatively successful using that as a domestic issue in Colombia.
No, Santos was the first sitting head of state in Latin America to tell the United States, you know what, the drug war is not working. Let's think about new ways of prosecuting this.
All the elections ahead in the year that will be, and you can follow it all along here. Politics on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tim Padgett and Sammy Mack with WLRN. Thank you and Happy New Year to both of you.
And to you.
And from the Miami Herald, Mark Caputo and Mary Ellen Kloss. Both again, thank you so much for the insights and health and happiness in the new year.
Happy New Year.
To everyone as well. Thank you so much. This is the Florida Roundup on the program here, produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer here at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. South Florida Arts Beat is next, and Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy, the year ahead for some key drivers for the South Florida economy, trade, travel, and real estate. It's Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy. I'll talk with you then. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.